This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my head up is scratching while my thoughts are busy hatching. If I only had a brain.
We're getting malleable with your mind today on All in the Mind here on ABC Radio National. Natasha Mitchell with you, welcome.
With the thoughts I'd be thinking, I could be another Lincoln if I only had a brain.
Last week, Canadian psychiatrist Dr. Norman Doidge introduced us to his adventures into the labs and lives of the so-called neuroplasticians, scientists fundamentally challenging the dogma that the brain is a rigid, unrenewable organ.
And I would not be just nothing, my head all full of stuff and my heart all filled with pain. And perhaps I deserve you, even be worthy of you if I only had.
As you'll hear in today's conversation, neuroplasticity has a forgotten heritage. And we're putting the concept on the couch too. How might psychotherapy, that process of reassessing and restructuring your thoughts, physically change the brain?
If I only had a brain, set a scarecrow.
People have often thought that, you know, real treatments are always biological and involve drugs, etc., and that talk therapy is just that. It's just talk, mere talk. But we now have really important work of psychoanalytic psychotherapies, cognitive behavior therapy, interpersonal therapy, which kind of grows out of psychoanalytic therapy, that shows that patients come in with brains in certain states of wiring, and after these interventions, their brains are rewired. So psychotherapy is every bit as biological as the use of medicines, and I would say, in a certain respect, more precise at times.
Dr. Norman Doidge is based at Columbia University's Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research in New York and the University of Toronto's Department of Psychiatry. And his book, The Brain That Changes Itself, Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science, has landed him on the New York Times bestseller list. Despite the dogma, the prehistory of neuroplasticity reaches as far back as the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau and before.
If I only had an ounce of common sense.
The ancient Greeks weren't in principle opposed to the idea. Socrates in the Republic says, you can exercise the organ of thought the way athletes exercise when they do gymnastics. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau read the Greeks, and he talked about exercising each of the senses. And out of that point of view, certain experiments were done shortly after Rousseau died in the early 1800s, where they took animals and they raised some of them in enriched environments with a lot of stimulation and others in normal environments, and they found that those who raised in the enriched environments had bigger brains. And there were many versions of this, but they often got buried in the literature because people just, they questioned the reliability of the experiments, they questioned the integrity at times of the scientists, because there was this other notion that was so rigidly adhered to.
There were also moral concerns, though, about, for example, some of Rousseau's ideas. I mean, he had this idea that if our minds were plastic, then humans had this sort of, were able to evolve and grow, and he had a concept of human perfectibility, I gather.
Yeah, he was very profound about this. He, you know, animals are plastic, too, to a degree. But when he compared human beings to other species, he noticed how much human beings change in the course of their lives, and he called this perfectibility, and the French word perfecté came into fashion. Unfortunately, there were many utopian ideas during the French Revolution that cottoned on to his notion, and it was picked up by the Russian Revolution, and you got to a point where progressive thought was very much dependent on this notion of human perfectibility. There was even an American stream that came through Condorcet and Thomas Jefferson that led to the self-help movement and many other things. But the problem was pointed out originally by Rousseau himself, the moral problem of it, and it was this. If you look at the ancients, like Aristotle and Plato, they often thought that for a human being to perfect himself or herself meant to cultivate your individual faculties as much as possible, but that each of these faculties had a kind of limit and a certain essence about them. And what Rousseau had observed is that you could marry various different mental faculties and create new faculties and adjust senses. And this meant that if human beings were truly perfectible and changeable in that sense, we didn't really know what a perfect human being looked like, because each human being could develop in a very individual way. So he always used the word perfectibility in quotes, and which is a brilliant, brilliant observation, because insofar as the brain is more modifiable than we believed, we require even more wisdom, not less, to know what to do with this potential. A changeable brain is more resilient, yes, indeed, but it's also much more vulnerable to the environment and the influences in what we do. And the other problem is when it gets into the political realm and we start to accept that human beings' brains can change and improve themselves, is what happens when someone doesn't change and improve? You saw this happen with the Russian Revolution. If people didn't move in the right direction, then the state said they must be bad people. And I've been concerned as I've tried to help articulate the importance of this new idea, which is very important and overall hopeful and good, that when people look to, you know, children who are having learning disorders who don't change when they've had neuroplastic exercises, which I've seen with my own eyes really remarkable results for many, many, many children, will they again be blamed? Because, look, neuroplasticity is an incredibly important discovery, but anyone with any degree of scientific maturity knows that you have to be very cautious even in light of something like this, and it doesn't mean we understand everything. And our task is to begin to understand how much plasticity there is inherent in the human brain, but also its limits, and articulate that for people. We're beginning to quantify a property that's always been there that we didn't recognize.
Norman Doidge, let's come to your therapeutic setting. You're a psychiatrist and psychoanalyst. What would Freud have thought of all this, this idea that the brain is a profoundly plastic organ?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because in a certain sense, Freud did think of all of this. In the 1880s, he was one of the very first people to propose that when we think and learn, we change the connections between nerve cells. He was very, very prescient on this point. And modern-day neuroplasticians, which is a term I have for people who have helped further our understanding of neuroplasticity, often talk about a basic law of plasticity that states neurons that fire together wire together, and neurons that fire apart wire apart. This is a very monumental discovery as to how connections are formed in the brain. Sometimes they attributed that to a Canadian-American who became a Canadian, Donald Hebb, and called it Hebbian plasticity. But in fact, Freud proposed that idea in the 1880s and 90s, and he called it the law of association by simultaneity. It's beautifully named, and it just meant that when you put two things together in consciousness, they get associated in the neuronal connections in the brain. And if you hear the word association with respect to Freud, you think of free association and, you know, saying everything that comes to mind, and Freud's emphasis that you could find important links. And in fact, it was related to his work as a neurologist. You know, he was never a psychiatrist. He was a neuroscience researcher before he turned to treating patients. Psychoanalysis grew out of these neuroplastic insights, and many of the other therapies that have grown out of psychoanalysis bear that heritage. And one of the most exciting and important things about this work is people have often thought that, you know, real treatments are always biological and involve drugs, etc., and that talk therapy is just that. It's just talk, mere talk. But we now have really important work of psychoanalytic psychotherapies, cognitive behavior therapy, interpersonal therapy, which kind of grows out of psychoanalytic therapy, that shows that patients come in with brains in certain states of wiring, and after these interventions, their brains are rewired. So psychotherapy is every bit as biological as the use of medicines, and I would say, in a certain respect, more precise at times. Now look, I use medications from time to time. I never give medication without giving psychotherapy. The Canadian healthcare system allows me to do that. But I think that's really, really important, because medications basically bathe every cell in your brain at once. And in that sense, they're on that level, they're a blunt instrument. Now, there are times when they have very, very important results. I'm not saying anyone should go off their medication and all that kind of thing, the kind of reductionist approach. But one of the things we've learned is that if you look at the letter A and then you close your eyes and think of the letter A, many of the same circuits are activated. And if you're hurting and talking with your therapist about that, those circuits are activated at that point. And that provides a point of entry. And when therapy is working, it's like a microsurgical intervention on precisely the circuits that have to be changed.
You've provocatively called psychoanalysis the new neuroplastic therapy. That's quite a claim, given that, I guess, today psychoanalysis is a bit on the nose in neuroscience circles.
Well, actually, at the heights of neuroscience, it's not. It's actually treated with great respect. Eric Kandel, who won the Nobel Prize in the year 2000 and is a great neuroplastician for actually showing how learning changes, turns on genes and changes structures, has written a whole book on psychoanalysis and neurobiology.
And his key field is, of course, memory, which is
yes.
The great example
he
of
He went into it, actually. He was a Viennese person who went into psychiatry to become an analyst and wanted to understand more about how learning works because learning is essential to psychotherapy. Gerald Edelman, who won the Nobel Prize, is interested in it. Antonio Damasio is. At the highest levels, I think there's a tremendous amount of respect for the integrative work that Freud did, not for every little detail of what he did. No one's making that claim. He was always revising his work. But on this particular point about neuroplasticity, psychoanalysis gave us a much more plastic understanding of how memory works, a much more plastic understanding of how emotion works, and that change was possible later in life.
So give us an example of how, in a therapeutic setting, you apply some of this thinking. And there are some lovely examples in the book.
There are examples in strokes, where people have had strokes and their brain goes into shock after the stroke. They try to use their affected arm. It doesn't work. So they kind of learn it doesn't work. And that is what we call learned non-use. That's a treatment by Dr. Edward Taub. And then we start to rely on our good arm. And it's a use it or lose it brain. The good arm gets better. And the weak arm, if there was anything left in the area, gets weaker. And what he did is he literally put a sling on the good arm and forced people to incrementally use their bad arms. And what we find on brain scans is areas around the harmed area, areas around the injured area of the stroke, take over for those cells.
Interestingly, from a psychoanalytic perspective, you point to the presence and persistence of childhood conflicts as being explainable in terms of plasticity. And you talk about unmasking some of those older experiences.
Right. People often say, what's the use of talking about the past? Well, sometimes it can be counterproductive, but often it's productive because when we've had an early childhood trauma, development doesn't stop. It proceeds apace, but in a slightly distorted way. And those old damaged networks are still there. I describe in detail a case of a man who came to me in his late 50s who couldn't form any relationships and he had trouble with alcohol. He couldn't be faithful to people he even cared about. And we traced it back to the death of his mother when he was, I think, about 26 months old. Well, it turned out all of those events were registered in his brain, but they were kind of obscured by later development. Unmasking basically means there were pathways laid down earlier on that are no longer used as extensively, but they're still there. The way to think about it is this. One of the ways we can create plastic change is rediscovering old pathways. So, for instance, if there's the road from here to from Melbourne to Sydney, and for some reason or other the bridge is washed out, what the commuters are going to begin to do is they're going to find old pathways. They're not as efficient and they take you a bit out of their way. And those old buried pathways can often give rise in patients to neurotic symptoms. But they can also be retraced and revivified and then changed when revivified. One of the things we know, this is a very important point in general about neuroplastic change, we've discovered that when you remember something, you revivify a particular network and it enters a state that goes from being kind of consolidated and difficult to change to, once remembered, a more plastic state again. And so we now understand why it's important to remember. We know the chemical pathways that are involved. And this is in some ways very promising because There are new treatments, many treatments now, where we treat post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a great example of a disorder that teaches us about plasticity. Someone's doing fine, then they get in a car accident or someone holds them up, and they have a kind of nervous breakdown, to use a very old-fashioned term, which actually I think makes a lot of sense. They can't function well nervously, and they can't separate past from present and so on and so forth. And we get them in a very safe condition and in all sorts of different ways. We then try to get them to remember the aspects of the accident piece by piece. And while they're remembering it in a safe place, they can begin to rewire their brains and put it behind them.
Talking about evidence, though, you're using some of these principles in your own therapeutic work with patients and clients as a psychoanalyst. Is it too early to be translating some of these ideas into working with the neuroses that people have about their own lives, pasts and presents and futures?
Well, I think that these are early days, but already I think I've certainly... Look, one of the most important things is that it's not too early to do is really to change the attitude. It, you know, used to be thought that development is really child development or adolescent development. When they talked about adult development, it was usually something like we enter a stage where we accept we're going to die and we want to pass on what we know to other people. It was, to a degree, the counsel of despair, and the idea was as you develop, you start to lose brain cells, but hopefully you can be wise and recognize important patterns. But there really is such a thing as adult development. It's really much more possible than we ever believed. And that has major implications for psychotherapy, including changing long-standing habits. I've learned a lot from people who do rehab as to how to practice psychotherapy, how to sort of set up roadblocks so that they don't develop certain kinds of grooves in behavior which get worse and worse, and the role of new behaviors.
There's always the risk of neurobabble, though, entering the clinic. And there is a lot of neurobabble out there.
Yeah.
Because neuro has become a prefix for everything.
Yeah.
That's risky,
yes.
Isn't it? Because people are really prone to believing
neurobabble. Yeah.
If neuroscience says this is the right way to go about things, then it must be right.
Yeah, but it's not just neurobabble. I mean, just as you shop around carefully for when you're buying a stereo, when you're looking for a good book on neuroscience or when you're looking for a good clinic, you've got to really try to educate yourself. But the fact is, anybody who has a brain, who does anything that involved in the brain, could lay claim to being a practitioner of neuroplasticity. I reserve that term for people who've extended our knowledge of the field. But sure, people will be climbing on this bandwagon, and it'll be abused and simplified and misunderstood. But that much being said, I think I owed it to people to say, look, we've been too negative about this. And understand the limits of plasticity and what's possible. And you can probably do a lot more than you thought you could.
An optimistic view of your malleable mind with psychiatrist Dr. Norman Doidge, author of The Brain That Changes Itself. He's my guest today on All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. I'm Natasha Mitchell, going global on Radio Australia online and as podcast. You suggest that even though our brain is very plastic, in fact we get into plastic traps. And also, interestingly, there's a great plastic paradox that you name, which has some therapeutic consequences.
Yeah, one of the most important things I learned when I stood back from all the research was what I call the plastic paradox, and it's this in a sentence, that the same brain that gives rise to so many flexible behaviors also gives rise to our rigid ones, many of our bad habits, etc. And that's because plasticity is competitive, and you establish a network, it gets efficient, and then it kind of bullies out the other networks. And plasticity is like snow on a hill in winter. If we're going to ski down that hill, because the snow is plastic and pliable, we can take many different paths down that hill. Not an infinite number. There are rocks here and trees over there. And if we had a good pass down the first time, being human, we'll tend to favor a path close to that the second and third times. And then, because the snow's pliable and plastic, we'll develop tracks which can become ruts and we can get stuck in them, brain lock. And they get worse. And many of the plastic treatments basically find ways of setting up neuroplastic treatments, roadblocks, so that you can get out of those ruts and learn about new pathways and grow new pathways, etc.
Is there any one story? Because in fact, you did a world tour, didn't you, of neuroplasticians, as you call them, people who are working to research on, reveal the dimensions of our plastic brain. Is there any one story that sort of is emblematic of how exciting this all is?
I'm very moved by the work of Paul Bachirida. Because he really was the first of his generation to argue for plasticity, and he had a very, very personal kind of story. And then he did just amazing work showing that our senses are plastic. And his father, Pedro Bachirida, was a Catalan poet and a very independent man. And when he was in his late 60s, he had a devastating stroke. And he went for the usual rehab, and at the end of it, he basically couldn't move. And the doctors called his son, George Bachirida, who was a medical student at the time, who, you know, find a place for him to spend the rest of his life as an invalid. George, his son, had no preconceived notions of rehabilitation. So he just took him down where he was studying medicine to Mexico. And he basically got him on the ground. And he said, Papa, you learned to walk by first learning to crawl as a baby. We're going to get you to do that. He got him down to do that. And once he could do that, he got him to do it against a wall outside with lifting one hand on the wall so that he was now just on three limbs. And the neighbors looked in and said it was unseemly what the boy was doing to Papa. And gradually he got him standing up. And then using the same kinds of incremental principles, Pedro Bachirida taught himself to type by lifting his arm and smashing it down on the typewriter, then smashing just the wrist and then one finger at a time. By the end of about a year of this, he was actually functioning. He had been a widower. He remarried. He started teaching again. And 7 years later, he was climbing a mountain in Bogota, Colombia. And he collapsed with a heart attack. And he was brought back. And at this point, it was now Paul Bachirida's turn to take over. And he ordered an autopsy on his father. And this is where it really gets interesting. Because a couple of days later, he was called down to the pathology lab. And there on the table spread before him were slices of his father's brain.
Amazing.
And he was, of course, numb and shocked. But he saw something in those slices. What he saw was the original lesion caused by the stroke. 97 to 98% of parts of the brain and the tracts of the parts of the brain involved in movement were still obviously damaged. And this meant one thing to Paul Bachirida. It meant that the work Papa had done with his brother so many years before had recruited new areas to take over these movements. So Paul Bachirida was then launched as a champion of what he called late brain plasticity. And late brain is important not just because it can help elderly people who have had strokes, but it means that plasticity exists from cradle to grave. And he invented these utterly unique inventions which allowed people who had had, you know, loss of sensory capacities to rewire them. And I opened the book with this remarkable story of a woman who's perpetually falling because her balance system was wiped out by a drug. And, you know, iatrogenic problem or just a bad side effect. And he learned how to rewire her brain so that she could get the balance input, it sounds bizarre, through her tongue. And she was able to be completely recovered. And he used similar things, mechanisms, teaching people who'd been blind since birth to see for the first time. And it's really, really remarkable.
Seeing through sensations
yes.
in their skin.
Yes.
Effectively, their skin becomes their seeing organ.
Yeah.
Not the damaged bit
right.
of their visual brain, which is remarkable.
Yeah, and it's quite remarkable to go and see a man who's completely blind take a basketball and sink it, getting this input through a camera, which is then going through the part of the brain that is involved in touch, which we now know then the brain finds a way to connect up more to the visual cortex. So unfortunately, Paul Bachirida recently passed away just as this, you know, all of his prophetic work was beginning to be believed.
Because he was a maverick for so long, wasn't
yeah,
he?
He was a great creative visionary. And so I have a special place in my heart for him.
Have you been in documenting all these stories of people with stroke recovering, of people with half a brain living a complete life, by no means with not half a mind, with a full mind in half a brain? Have you been flooded with letters and emails from
yes,
people whose brains have been possibly compromised and
yes,
they've
I
therefore
have.
Had a sort of compromised experience? They want solutions, they want cures.
Yes, I have. I have. And some people can be helped, but I'm just one guy. And so I encourage people to go to the book because I've put what I know about plasticity into the book, and those people can, you know, generally be contacted. Yeah, it's been remarkable. One of the noble things about being a physician is sometimes you're willing to tell people. You're willing to say the thing that no one else wants to say. If you really truly think a person's dying, or you really truly think they have a deficit that can't be dealt with, doctors say so. And it's not because they're just gloomy figures. But if they're not going to tell the truth, who is? And, you know, people sometimes have to get their affairs in order, or they have to know what they're dealing with to mobilize themselves to deal with it and grieve and go on. But the problem is, of course, we have to be very well informed about what is impossible. And because our theory and our model of the brain was underestimated its capacities, many mistakes have been made. And because we didn't know enough about plasticity, we didn't know how to conduct rehab as effectively as we're now learning how to do. You know, when I started out in medicine, rehab, I mean to insult nobody, but rehab was a very, very depressing thing. And in some ways, it seemed like an intellectual backwater because people are working with a brain that can't change and so on and so forth. You can imagine that that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And indeed, it did. But now with the work of the neuroplasticians, I think rehab is one of the most exciting parts of medicine. And that's as it should be.
Norman Doidge, where does this leave all those just-so stories that are still prescribed to by many, that we possess a hunter-gatherer brain, a brain whose essential form and function evolved millennia ago?
Well, that's interesting. It's true that we possess a brain that evolved in the Serengeti and has hunter-gatherer components. But one of the things that our hunter-gatherer forebears evolved to be was particularly plastic. And that means that there is not just Darwinian evolution that we have to think about, but we have to think about our own individual neuroplastic evolution. Each of us as individuals have changing brains over the course of our lives. The map of your face in your brain, if we were to remap it 3 weeks from now, is different than it is today. And your brain's maps are going to be determined by what you do in a day-to-day way. So the great gift of our hunter-gatherer forebears was a gift that gives us an extraordinary ability to become individuals in many ways. And so it's not all genetically determined in that sense. Or another way to put it would be the human genetic inheritance includes plasticity. Our genes have two kind of fundamental properties. One of them is something that's not easily in our control, which is they replicate themselves. And so we're born with a certain set of genes. Nothing much at this point we can do about that. But the other aspect of...
We can switch them on and off, though.
Yes.
How we live our life.
Yes. The other aspect of genes is they're turned on and off all the time. When you go to sleep, some are turned on and others are turned off. And when you wake in the morning, other switches are thrown. But it turns out that thoughts also throw these switches. And this gives us a lot more control. So against the genetic determinism, I would say the following. It turns out that neuroplasticity, by showing that consciousness changes brain structure, leaves an important place for free will in human functioning. Look, it's never... with the rarest of exceptions, either nature or nurture. We evolved to be nurtured. It's always how much nature and how much nurture. And neuroplasticity, in a way, is about self-nurture.
Norman Doidge, congratulations on the book, and thank you for joining me on the program.
Thank you so much.
And a reminder that Dr. Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself, is published in Australia by Scribe. More info on the All in the Mind website, along with our email and the downloadable audio of the last two shows on matters plastic. And by midweek, a transcript. Check out the All in the Mind blog too. Read it, post to it and participate. All at abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind. My thanks to producer Anita Barrow. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next week, Skeptical Thinking.
I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's clouds' illusions I recall.
I really don't know cloud.
If you haven't heard of cloud computing, join the Petabyte Age on Background Briefing. You can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.